It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Horticulture Day. And do you remember early this summer when it seemed like maybe half of the calls on Horticulture Day were about trees that looked terrible? We had wet conditions, we had dry conditions, hot conditions, a few cooler than normal days. So it's time to assess the long-term consequences of all of that weather for our trees. Jeff Iles is professor and chair of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University, here to do our assessment. Hello, Jeff.
Charity, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here.
It's always great to come.
And Richard Geron is also here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And I want to start with fall color first, because the DNR says it has reached its peak around the state. Here in eastern Iowa, it's really beautiful. I don't know if it's a stunning year, but it's really nice. How are things looking in central Iowa?
Pretty good. I think we had some dire predictions early on because of all the wet weather that we had. But I think the fall color season's really turned around. I'm picking up more yellow than normal, and that could be a reflection of the weather conditions. But it's made a nice recovery, so we're enjoying it over here in central Iowa as well.
All right, a good weekend to go for a nice long drive or a bike ride or a hike.
Definitely.
That's good too.
Definitely. Yeah.
All right, so Jeff, early this summer we heard nothing but calls about sad trees. And of course, things were really wet early. Let's recap how conditions went through the summer, because it was flooding to begin with, and then things changed.
It's a job security for horticulturists,
right?
Charity. I mean, it's like politics. Where would we be without problems? But you're right. I mean, think about living in the Midwest. This is a challenging climate for people and for woody plants. And woody plants, of course, can't pick up and leave or come inside. So you're right. It was wet early on. The winter wasn't all that noteworthy. It was snowy, but it wasn't. We had a couple of really cold nights. But keep in mind that all of these environmental stresses build on one another. So you have cold, you have wet springs, and then it was hot and dry this summer. In fact, it seemed like there were 2 months where it didn't rain, and it was dry, and that put a lot of trees and shrubs into a stress mode. And then now it's turned off very wet, and that's been nice. It's filling up the aquifer, filling up the ponds and streams, and replenishing soil moisture, but it's made it tough for farmers. And I think woody plants are totally confused. In fact, if you walk around the landscape, and Richard and I were noticing this on the walkover this morning, there are a lot of woody plants that are flowering this time of the year, flowering when they normally flower in the spring. So your lilacs, your crabapples, viburnum, magnolias. We've seen a lot of precocious, that's what it's called, precocious flowering this time of the year. And so I think things are kind of turned upside down on their heads, and it makes you wonder, well, what can I do to buffer these extremes in the weather? And I'm not sure I have a good answer.
You want to try to answer that?
I kind of hung myself out to dry on that one. And you know, there is no magic. We go back to right plant, right place. And if we've chosen appropriate plants for the landscape, then they'll be able to weather these extremes. But really, all we can do is wait and pick up the pieces at the other end. And so it's always dicey. We always want to know how the plants are going to respond and what they'll look like come spring. And that's a great question. We can prognosticate that one. But then we can prune, we can fertilize, we can water when necessary. But if we've made the right choices in the landscape, chosen the right plants, then a lot of these problems are not as dire as they might seem.
Well, I think a lot of people that see the trees blooming right now really do panic and think, oh no, you know, is this plant going to be dead in the spring? Is that an overreaction?
It is. And I think the only downside is that you might not see the full-blown floral display that we're used to seeing on some plants if they're flowering. Now, remember, those flower buds were set back in June, early July. And so those were the flower buds that would have given us the show next April and May. If they're flowering now, then, of course, we're losing some of that effect. But, you know, it doesn't really have much of an effect on the overall plant health. It's more of an aesthetic issue.
Let's talk about sycamore trees, because I think that sycamore were the ones that we heard the most about this spring, as far as people saying they just look terrible. I'm worried that we're going to lose it.
Right.
What do you think? How did sycamores fare by the end of the summer?
Sycamores are one of those just lunch pail trees, blue collar trees. They look rough in the spring because of a disease called anthracnose, and it happens every year. This year, it was particularly bad because of the wet, cool conditions we had. but they recover. They always recover, and they recovered very well this year. So I don't worry about those trees that are affected by spring defoliators, whether that be insect or disease, because normally they get their act together by midsummer. And Richard and I, again, we're just talking about this, and they look pretty darn good now. So it'll probably happen again next spring, maybe not to the same degree that we saw this spring. But the sycamore anthracnose is kind of like the common cold, I guess. You get it, and then you move on.
With the moisture this spring, I mean, as you mentioned, that was good for anthracnose. Was that good for other tree diseases as well? Just a nice breeding?
A lot of fungal diseases appreciate those kinds of conditions that we had this spring. So apple scab on crab apple, ash anthracnose. So a lot of these fungal pathogens seem to really enjoy those kind of weather events. And of course, as we moved on into the growing season, into the summer, Japanese beetles seem to have a heyday with lindens. A lot of little leaf lindens, which is the European linden, really was hit hard by Japanese beetle infestation this summer. And so if you saw your lindens looking a bit rough, a little brown, a lot brown, then it was probably due to Japanese beetles. And so the question, once again, is, well, what's the long-term effect of Japanese beetle infestations year after year? And it doesn't seem to slow the lindens down. I mean, you would think it would, but they never seem to miss a beat. Now, it's not a good look. It's not something you want in your landscape. But I'm a big fan of lindens. It seemed like the American lindens weren't hit as hard this summer, but it's all over the board. So keeps us busy, Charity.
We spent quite a bit of time talking about the many different things that are making oak trees struggle this summer and recently every summer. What are you feeling about oaks right now?
You know, there's a lot of concern about bur oak, which to me has always been kind of our native bur oak or native oak tree in the state. And there's a fungal disease called bur oak blight, which we noticed, probably 15, 20 years ago, and it seems to be gaining strength, gaining momentum in the state. And it's one of those diseases that when it finds a tree, it tends to sit on that tree and get worse as the years go on. So it's not going to take your tree out in a hurry, but it's one of those chronic problems that wears a tree down after a while. And, you know, without seeing a plant sample or without, you know, I mean, I'm kind of shooting from the hip here, but I think there's general concern about bur oak blight in the state. And when you consider how many bur oaks we have in the state and what a prominent place they hold in our natural landscapes and in our managed landscapes, that's a concern. There are some things we can use. There are some fungicide treatments that we can use, but you know, there's an expense associated with that. So, you know, what's the message? Well, diversify. If you have a lot of bur oak in your neighborhood, then of course you might investigate other oaks or other kinds of trees to plant. We tend to throw that D word around a lot, but if your landscape is represented with lots of species, then you're better able to fend off some of these problems. And who knows what the next problem will be? You know, emerald ash borer is kind of old hat now, but many parts of the state are just beginning to see the effects of emerald ash borer and what it's done to our native ash population.
With the on-again, off-again flooding that we have in Iowa in so many places, I mean, it was extreme. It was very extreme in some parts of the state this year, but those parts of the state are also no strangers to floods.
Right.
We see these valleys, these places, these floodplains that get flooded again and again,
right,
and a lot of them have trees living in them. What are the long-term consequences of that? I mean, some trees are well-suited, but not all, right?
Right. Well, you know, I was talking to a colleague of mine up in the northeastern part of the state, and he was mentioning that they've had high water for a long, long time. And yes, we expect the sycamores, the ash, the silver maples to put up with inundation, but for how long? And we're seeing these long stretches of flooding in areas where, yeah, we get flooding, but it never lasts as long as it has. And he remarked to me that he's seeing some decline in these floodplain species that never used to be affected that way. And so it's a great question. You know, the climate is changing. Something's going on, and we can't quite figure it out. And I'm not sure what we can do about that. I'm a big fan of bald cypress. They don't seem to be bothered at all by inundation if it happens year-round. But, man, there's just always something new out there for us to try to explain.
When people are planting trees, do you think it's important to ask yourself the question, am I in a floodplain? Am I going to have water here in the future? And choose a tree that's really tolerant of that?
Yeah, always. That's always the case. And, you know, some of our listeners might live in those areas that are temporarily inundated by floodwaters. And, of course, choosing the right species. We just mentioned bald cypress is a good one. And or don't plant in those areas. That might maybe even be a better tact. Or plant high. Even in a upland property, you might want to plant high if your soils don't drain very well. There's no telling what the weather is going to be doing. But it seems like we're in these periods where we have stretches of feast and famine. We have lots of water, and then we don't have enough. So we have to be ready with the garden hose and also be ready with the bucket to bail ourselves out.
Well, and planting in a floodplain, we see a lot of people planting rain gardens and things like that.
Yeah.
Can there be a benefit to planting in a floodplain as far as maybe mitigating some of those effects?
I don't know about that.
All right.
It sounds good.
It's a good theory.
We could practice in your yard.
I don't live in a floodplain, but
there's the advice. Don't buy a new home in a floodplain.
That's the first thing I look at. With some of the fruit trees, cherry trees, for example, I mean, I know that we've got cold conditions that also affect them, but they don't necessarily like soggy feet. Did we lose any fruit trees this year because of the rains in the spring?
I don't think you're going to see anything maybe until maybe next year or the following year. It's not going to happen immediately, but the fruit trees as a group do not like wet feet. So they may have had some problems, and I guess what I'd be looking for maybe next spring would be trees that leaf out maybe poorly, where they have fewer leaves than normal, where the leaves might be smaller than normal, that type of thing, and they may not flower or produce much fruit. So if I see that, I see a tree in stress.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to answer your questions. With me, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Jeff Iles, Professor and Chair of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. You can call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Jeff Iles, Professor and Chair of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. They are here to answer your questions. So give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Luann is on the line in Johnston. Hi, Luann.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in a townhouse association, and the association is thinking about planting a bicolor oak tree and also a State Street maple tree. And my question is, would it be wise to plant it this fall or to wait until next spring to plant these two trees?
Great question, Luann. And those are both really good plants, Quercus bicolor or the swamp white oak, and then State Street maple, which has become a real popular maple tree for us here in the state of Iowa. If these are container-grown plants, and I assume they might be, even if they're not, if they're bald and burlap trees, I think we could still plant safely this time of the year. You know, you don't want to be planting too late in the fall season, but I think the window is still open. So if we plant them properly, mulch them, water them a little bit, they should be just fine. But those are both great selections.
Oh, great. And they are bag and burlap trees.
Okay, very good. And so consider this, they've already been dug from the growing field, and if we don't plant them, they would just sit in a nursery all winter anyway. So you might as well get them in the ground, get some root growth going, and then they'll be fine to go next spring.
All right, Luann, thank you so much for calling. Next up, we've got Alfonso in Des Moines. Hi, Alfonso.
Hi. My question, I have a two-part question. First one is, I live in an apartment, so I started growing some chilies from seed this year. And I grew jalapenos, and I grew pepperoncinis, where they're both kind of Well, jalapenos are green and pepperoncinis are like a light green, yellowish. But I planted them next to each other in two different pots, and they turned out to be, they came out red. Nice, bright yellow, I mean, red. It was stunning. So my question is, why did they come out red? I mean, had to do with the soil, cross-pollination?
It's
that quick question.
It's not a cross-pollination thing. Sure, they might cross-pollinate, but it does not affect the current year's fruit. So if you plant a specific variety, you'll get that variety. Now, if you save the seed, the next year's plant might be genetically different, but it won't be as far as the first year. So it has nothing to do with cross-pollination. So possibly you got the wrong seed. Maybe it was mislabeled or something, but it has nothing to do with cross-pollination.
Okay, because, I mean, I bought the two seeds package from the store, and the picture was, you know, pepperoncini was yellowish, and the jalapenos, they look green, and it came out red.
How did they taste, so Alfonso?
I mean, the jalapenos were not that spicy, which kind of like, I like spicy. But, I mean, they taste great. I mean, I made omelets with it, you know.
Nice.
I love the chilies, but I was just, that it was interesting that they both came out red. So that's, I mean, yeah. And the other thing is about the seeds. If I want to keep the seeds for next year to grow them, how does that process work?
Well, if you were to save the seed, you would simply remove those from a mature fruit, like a red one. That's typically when they're mature. You could wash the seed very carefully, then dry it. And then when the seeds are thoroughly dry, just put them in a little packet and store them in a cool, dry place until next spring. But they may not be genetically true, depending on if they were a hybrid or whatever. So they may not be exactly copies of the parents.
Well, Alfonso, thank you so much for your call. Next up, let's go to Angie in Johnston. Hi, Angie.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question. Yeah, I have a question regarding grass clippings. So what I've done is when we mow, we go ahead and put our grass clippings into the vegetable garden, and we do that to help with weed suppression.
Mm-hmm.
I have also noticed this year that, and previous years, that I've got probably septoria leaf spot on my tomatoes, and I grew butternut squash this year, so of course I had squash bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question has to do with what do I do with the grass clippings right now? Do I go ahead and till them into the garden to add nutrients and more compost, in a sense, to the garden soil, or do I bag that when hoping to try and get rid of some of the disease and pests that I've been dealing with?
What I would do is I would pull out the tomato plants and remove them from the garden and discard them elsewhere, possibly the same with the squash. And then if the garden is fairly level, I think I would go ahead and till the grass clippings into the soil.
Will do. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Angie. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Here's a question from Mandy. We planted quite a few trees on our farm near Denison last fall, including a few bur oaks. The trees look great. However, late this spring, we noticed the bark on the top of a 12-foot bur oak had begun peeling off. Mm. It has gotten progressively worse, and we're not sure what's causing it. Now the leader is completely dead and the peeling bark has spread to other branches. We also have a 20-year-old white pine showing signs of bark peeling off as well, but we're unsure if that's correlated or if it's just deer damage since it's on the low branches.
Mm. Great questions, Mandy. There's all kinds of things that could be going on here, Charity. Peeling bark and then, of course, death at the terminals could be some kind of a root issue, could be drought. Could be lots of things. I know I've said this before, and it must frustrate the listeners, but I need pictures. I need to see something here. And of course, usually this kind of a problem requires some give and take, some questions and answers. And so I invite Mandy to give me an email or send me some photos, and we can have a better conversation. This is the problem with radio.
Sure, it is. Sure. It's a distinct problem with radio. Yep.
But I love radio. I've got a face for radio. But I mean, I could just list 20 things that this could be. The good news is pruning the plant in the dormant season and seeing what happens is always a good way to go here.
All right. So, and she might want to get in touch with you or someone.
That'd be fine. She can contact me. And pictures are worth a lot in helping diagnose these kinds of problems.
All right, Mandy. Look for Jeff Iles. You can find him at Iowa State University. You can track him down. Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Next up, we have John in Cedar Rapids. Hi, John.
Hello, and thank you for your program.
Sure.
I have about a 35-foot boxwood hedge that suffered greatly last winter. I still have some plants or parts of plants that survived. I guess it's a three-part question. Can I take cuttings from those existing plants and propagate the boxwood to replant next year? Should I look at putting something else in lieu of it, or just go buy some new boxwood hedge?
Okay, you had 35 plants. What's the survival rate on those?
Oh, it's probably about 80%.
80% survived.
Oh, no, 80% are dead. Forgive me.
Okay, then I would remove them and put in something different. Boxwoods tend to be kind of iffy, very finicky, and if you've lost 80% of them, I would not replant with those. I would look at something entirely different, whether it's used if you want an evergreen, but definitely not go back with the boxwoods. I wouldn't.
Anything that is similar to a boxwood that you would recommend?
Boy, we don't really have a lot of broadleaf evergreens that do well in Iowa, so I think I might go with a yew. They're very dependable. They'll grow in sun or shade. They're quite adaptable. They can be pruned or sheared quite nicely, so they do well in Iowa. As far as a broadleaf evergreen, maybe one of the hollies, one of the Meserve hollies, they do pretty well if they have an eastern exposure. If they're not out in an open exposed area, they do pretty well. And they have the evergreen foliage, dark green, and the females do produce the fruit. And so they can be used in Iowa. They typically are more reliable, I think, than the boxwoods.
John, would you entertain a plant that drops its leaves in the winter?
That would be fine.
Because there's all kinds of other deciduous shrubs that, when planted on 3 or 4 foot centers, would eventually create a hedge. I'm not sure I'd want to shear it in a real formal fashion, but there are all kinds.
Well, these never were sheared formally.
Good, good. Well, then this plan might work. But I can think of, I mean, there's just all kinds of things. There are some dwarf lilac. There are some smaller sized viburnum that when planted, again, anywhere from 3 to 4 to 5 foot apart, center to center, that they'd eventually close and give you a very nice informal hedge, and you'd get some flowering and some fall color to boot.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, John, and good luck with that. Let's go to Dave next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
What would you like to talk about? Yeah. What's your question?
My question is, it's not so much related to plants, but I have a cabin up near Waukon in northeast Iowa, and every fall I get a massive amount of these small bugs. They look like ladybugs, but I don't think they are. And boy, I get like an inch of them on the floor inside my cabin. First of all, I'm wondering what those bugs are called, what the name of them are.
Okay. Do they have spots on them?
Yeah, they're orange with black spots, kind of like a lady bug.
Okay. I'm guessing they might be the Asian lady beetle, which is an introduced species, right, Asian lady beetle. And
they were imported then?
Well, they got introduced into the country by some means. I'm not sure how. And they're very common nowadays. And in the fall of the year, they look for a place that's kind of warm and protected, and that's where they overwinter. And if you have a structure where you have cracks and crevices where they can crawl in, they will crawl in. And so they tend to be kind of a nuisance insect in the fall of the year. The only way to deal with that typically is to, if you can, find the cracks and crevices and seal those. And if you have a large number, I think you have a major problem as far as cracks and crevices, because to get that many, the openings must be quite large and quite apparent. So
they know your secrets for sure.
So it may be a big chore to find every single crack and crevice, but that's what you have to do. As far as what gets in there, go after them with a vacuum.
A vacuum or a broom.
Yep.
Good luck,
broom.
Dave. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Faith in Moorville. Hi, Faith.
Yes, good morning. My question comes from a friend I have who recently moved to San Antonio, and she is mourning the loss of her beloved rhubarb she had to leave behind, but wonders if possibly some of her hostas would transplant to San Antonio.
Boy, that I'm not sure. I think they need to check with the extension staff at Texas A&M University. I'm sure they can probably tell them. Those plants typically like a dormant period, and I'm not sure if the dormant period in southern Texas is long enough for them to survive long term. I'm not sure. So I would check with gardening authorities in Texas.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Faith. Next, let's go to Dean in Mason City. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a ginkgo tree that's about 7 feet tall. This was its third season. And the tag on it from the nursery had a nice, beautiful lemony yellow color that it should show in fall. But it has stayed green each season. This season, I was hoping this will be the year for color. But the leaves are still very green and look like they're just going to drop green.
Yeah. Do you remember
so I was wondering what.
I'm sorry, Dean. I didn't mean to talk over you. Do you remember the name of the tree? Did it have a cultivar name?
No, I don't remember.
Just plain old ginkgo. Well, what you're describing isn't all that uncommon. In fact, we see quite a few here, even on campus, older specimens that have green leaves, and then all of a sudden they drop off all at once, and they never do turn yellow. And other individuals do that. One of the problems this year, and we might have alluded to this at the top of the hour, is it was awfully wet this fall, and that might dampen some fall color expression, especially on trees that are a little reluctant to do so. So all I can tell you is that you have to be patient. I'm pretty sure that someday this tree is going to start showing the fall color that you're expecting to see, but environmental conditions will sometimes play games with that. And younger trees sometimes don't always perform as those pictures that you see on tags. So there's nothing to be done for the plant. It seems like a little stress always brings out good fall color, but I'm certainly not advocating that you go out and
don't
and
go
stress
abuse your tree.
Plant.
Right.
There used to be a gardening expert that used to recommend hitting trees with the rolled up newspapers. That might be okay for dogs. No, that's not even okay for dogs, Charity. But you know what I'm saying. So don't. Dean, it's a frustration, I know, but just be patient. Ginkgos will test your patience anyway because they're so slow growing. But I'm convinced that this tree will finally find its way in the world.
All right, Dean, thanks a lot for your call. We'll do a couple emails here. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to answer this question because it's a little vague, but we'll try. This is from Tom. He says, I have bulbs galore that were pulled from the ground in May. They have since sat indoors and have stayed dry. I'd like to plant them and hope for the best. Do you recommend soaking the roots or any soil amendment?
Well, if they were spring flowering bulbs like tulips and daffodils, I guess I would check on their condition. If they still seem solid and firm, I would just go ahead and plant them. They don't have to soak them or anything. Just go ahead and plant them. But if they feel like they're kind of hollow and dried up, they probably have died. They don't store very well, and it's possible they may have dried out and died. So check on their condition. If they're solid and firm, go ahead and replant them.
All right. And since they were pulled from the ground in May, if they're spring flowering bulbs, did they get enough time to feed the bulb before you pulled them?
Yeah, that's another issue. If they're tulips, probably not. so they may just send up foliage next spring. But if they're daffodils, they have the chance to recover from that, so they may not bloom next spring, but the following spring.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for your call. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Jeff Iles, Professor and Chair of the Horticulture Department at ISU. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, Jeff Iles, Professor and Chair of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. They are here to answer your questions. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mike is on the line next in Adel. Hi, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have a question about something I want to plant in my vegetable garden. So I've expanded my garden, and it's given me some extra space, so I want to try something kind of wacky or something different. And I was thinking about trying to plant some peanuts, but I have no idea if they'll survive or what I need to do with those. So I'm looking for some help to see if I'm just going to plant some stuff that's going to come up dead or if I'm going to have a bunch of peanuts at the end.
Okay. I've grown them myself. It's kind of a fun thing. They're not very productive when you grow them here in Iowa, but you would plant those in the spring, probably around mid-May or so. And they form this bushy plant, and then it has these very colorful yellow flowers. And then once they're done blooming, the flower stalk bends and pushes the fruit into the ground. And so the peanuts develop in the ground. And then you harvest them in the fall, probably around late September, early October. And you bring them in, and you dry them. And if you do that, you can actually harvest some peanuts. They usually don't develop very well here in Iowa, but it's kind of a fun thing to do. I've done it for several years. And the actual flowers are quite attractive, bright yellow. Pea-like flower.
Awesome.
All right.
Yeah. Do I need to be concerned about my soil at all? Is there any amendment that I need to put in or any composition I'm looking for there?
No, just make sure it's a well-drained, good soil, plenty of sun. And like I said, I would plant these around mid-May or so. They like the warm weather.
All right, Mike, have fun with that. Next up, we've got Elizabeth in Madrid. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. Hey, I have a tree. It's an oak tree. I don't know what kind of oak tree it is. Somebody gave it to me, and right now it's about 10 to 12 feet tall, and the top 3 feet are dead. And I'm wondering when's the best time to cut that off.
All right. So, Elizabeth, we prune oak trees during the dormant season. So I prefer, and I know Mark Vitash is probably listening right now, too.
And approving.
So, but dormant season, that's a pretty broad window. So I like February, early March. Because
that sounds good.
We want the wound to close, and it seems that once the growth commences in the spring, it does that pretty quickly. So hang on until about that time of the year. Be careful. This sounds like it's a bit off the ground, so be careful when you're up there on your stepladder. But that would be the time of the year.
Okay, thanks very much.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for your call, Elizabeth. Let's do a few emails here. This one's from Donna. Several years ago, we planted an American elm tree. The leaves are just turning brown and dry, then dropping. The remaining leaves are perforated and look like lace. I suspect Japanese beetle infestation. Any harm to the tree, and should I do anything?
Yeah. Well, the harm is negligible, I think. It's an aesthetic hit to the tree. There are some insecticides that sometimes can be used, but I don't know. I think I would just let it go. It's something we have to live with. I'm hoping that Japanese beetle populations begin to diminish. It seems like the longer they're in an area, the less problems they cause for us. It's probably a better question, better answer for Dr. Lewis. But no, I just notice it and realize that it's something we have to put up with for a while.
All right. Here's a question from Susan. What's the best way to get rid of the excessive amount of willow that has taken over our pond shores?
My wife and I are just dealing with this. We're going to be dealing with this very, very soon. Willows, of course, will make themselves at home, especially around wetland areas. And I spoke with Dr. Bob Hartzler here on campus because I want to get a handle on this before they take over. The problem is, and we always get in trouble by mentioning herbicides on this program, but I'm going to do it anyway. If you cut the willows back and treat the stumps with a non-selective herbicide, being very careful how you do this, then that might be a way through this. But, of course, there are a lot of herbicides you don't want to use anywhere near water. And so if these are in the dryland areas, then I think we're on pretty solid ground, so to speak, by cutting the willows back and treating that cut end with a non-selective product. But you've got to be very, very careful around waterways, around wetlands. In fact, this might be a better question for Hartzler to answer sometime for us. But this is a common problem. The thing is, if you don't do anything, the willows will take over, and then they've kind of muddied up the works. So something has to be done, right?
You could invite a beaver to live in your pond?
Beavers or kids with you know, you can always pay little children. Well, no, you don't want to do that either. But I've made a couple of faux pas here this morning. This has not been a good program, Charity. You're going to get lots of blame.
I think hiring a child to do an odd job is short of violating child labor laws.
Well,
but
you forget how old I am. So that was not a problem back in the day. But I appreciate the fact that the emailer wants to do something here. You can't just turn away. You can't just look the other way. This has to be addressed.
All right. Here's a question from Chap. He says, I live north of Ames in an older development. There is a venerable apple tree on the property. It has not been maintained. It is approximately 18 feet high, and it bears a lot of palatable fruit. My hope is this is an heirloom variety. Who could I contact to identify this tree?
Boy.
That's hard.
I don't think you can, okay. Unfortunately. There are many, many varieties, hundreds, and it's very, very hard. And right now, we don't have anybody on staff that can actually do that. So I don't think you can. Now, you don't need to know what it is to possibly propagate it, okay? So you could propagate it by a whip or tongue graft, which isn't really that difficult, and you have the exact same tree. You don't know what it is, but you have the same one, and you could keep on doing that forever.
Right, and that's how we got all of our
yes.
apple varieties, right? So you could give it a name, and then you have your own variety.
Yep, you could.
All right, question from Trey in West Des Moines. Is there a specific tree that attracts stink bugs? We seem to have an increasing population of them these days. Trey, you are not alone.
Trey. Stink bugs, and does he have any little children, by the way?
Not that I know of.
I don't know. Boy, this is another one that I wish we had an entomologist with us this morning. I don't know if stink bugs have a preference for trees. My guess is no. We do worry about this fairly new one called the brown marmorated stink bug, which is a problem on fruit trees and fruit crops. So that's an issue, but I can't think of any shade tree that would be bullied by a brown marmorated stink bug.
All right, but a lot of people are seeing them a lot more commonly, so you're probably not doing anything specific to get them. You just have them, right? Like
right.
the rest of us.
Right, right. Yeah, don't take it personally.
All right, Pat is on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have a question about Heavenly Blue Morning Glories, which I've been growing for years. In the last couple of years, I don't get very many blossoms. And I did go to a florist and ask what they thought. And they said they were having the same, a horticulture place, and they said they were having the same experience. So I just wondered if you've heard about that, if have any ideas about it.
Well, as far as blooming, they tend to bloom late in the year anyway.
They're usually profuse. I mean, there's a lot of them. I'm getting like three or four.
Right. So there are a couple of things.
Same places where I've gotten lots of them.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of things that you don't want to do. You don't want to fertilize them because.
No, I never do that.
Because fertilization would actually encourage vegetative growth and that would delay flowering. So. You don't want to do anything that would cause excessive growth. I would just say plant them and let them take care of themselves. A little stress again might cause them to bloom a little bit earlier and heavier, but don't do anything that would make them lush and very vigorous in growth.
That's so all you haven't heard of other people talking about that?
No, not really.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Pat. Next, we have Anne in Waverly. Hi, Anne.
Hello. I am calling because in the spring, I threw my Easter lily out on the deck with all the other house plants, and it died back. And I never got around to picking it back up. And now I have what look like multiple sprouts with the Easter lily type leaf. And I'm just wondering, can I nurse this thing along and have an Easter lily that I grew myself?
I'm not sure if it's going to bloom at this point. I mean, if you brought it inside, it would grow, but I'm not sure that it would bloom because it really wasn't exposed, I don't think, to cool temperatures, which typically is necessary for flower formation. So I think what I would do is, if I want to keep that, I would actually plant it in the ground. And
right now?
Right. Plant the bulb in the ground. The bulb should be about 6 inches deep. The growth will die back once it gets cold. And then hopefully it would come up again next spring. And if it does, it might bloom in June or July. But bringing it inside, I don't think it's going to do anything because it hasn't been exposed to cold temperatures.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Anne. Here is a question from a different Anne. This one is from an Anne in Cedar Rapids. She says, I have a dogwood tree approximately 8 to 10 years old on the east side of a rental house we own in Coralville. I treated both it and the linden tree nearby with systemic insecticide and fertilizer in the spring and watered it once in July before new tenants moved in, but otherwise left it alone most of the summer. A few weeks ago, I swung by the house to do some fall yard work and noted that the tree was dead. It does have quite a few sprouts near the base, so I cut off the 8 feet of dead tree above and left the sprouts. I cut a few of the smaller sprouts off, but I've left about 6. Question, should I cut off all the sprouts except for the single tallest, most vigorous sprout, or leave them all until spring? Should I protect them in any way? I can't really use tree wrap because the tallest sprout is only about 12 to 15 inches tall.
Right. So I would probably leave them all till next spring, choose the strongest one at that time, and then see what happens. I'm wondering why this dogwood gave it up, wondering what kind of a dogwood it is. If it's pagoda dogwood, they don't like a lot of heat and drought and sun, so that might have been the issue. But what the emailer has done is right. You've got something that's alive there, and you might have a tree that forms from one of those sprouts that are remaining.
All right, here's a question from Mark. Is it too late for broadleaf control for lawns in central Iowa?
Absolutely not. This weekend would be great. You probably have another 2 or 3 weeks.
All right, and it's not even going to be too punishing to be out doing yard
work
this weekend.
No, tomorrow would be great, I
think.
This
is the time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, from Greg in Story City, what do you think of the shamrock inkberry? We planted 5 this past spring to replace the evil barberry.
You know, when we were talking to, who was that earlier? I forget the gentleman. It was John from Cedar Rapids. I thought about inkberry. Inkberries would be kind of a look-alike to boxwood. I think it's a prettier plant. It's a green broadleaf evergreen. Likes a lower soil pH, likes a well-drained soil. We don't use a lot of it here in the state, but it might be something to play with. I forget, where's the emailer from?
Story City.
Story City. So up there, I'd want to give it a very protected site. But it's worth a try. I think winter hardiness is not the issue. It's more about soil conditions and maybe strong winds. I'd keep it out of strong winds. But I like the plant. It would be an alternative to boxwood.
All right. And since he already planted 5.
Oh, well, he should get back to us then. I'd like to know.
All right.
I'd like to know how it goes.
Larry's on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. It's good to hear your program again. I might be the only person you've talked to who has trouble growing rhubarb.
Oh, Larry, you're not alone. I actually have trouble with it, too. But go on.
Thank you. Well, I have a very sheltered, sunny position on the southwest side of my townhome, and it looks ideal. But I don't know if it's bad soil with a kind of a heavy clay soil, subsoil, or if it's the fact that it might get some drift from herbicides that are sprayed sometimes in the spring or sometime or summer, or just bad variety. I don't know what, but I have a close friend who has rhubarb that grows like weeds, and he can't, you know, shut it off. So what should I do?
Well, I would say rhubarb is a very tough, resilient plant, and its basic requirements are a good, well-drained soil. The plant does not like a wet, poorly drained site. That's not a good location for it. And the other requirement is basically plenty of sun. If it has plenty of sun, at least 6 hours of sun, direct sun per day, at least 6 hours, and a good, well-drained soil, typically it takes care of itself. There are some varieties that are more vigorous. If you have a clay soil, you might want to try to work in some organic matter, like compost or sphagnum peat moss. Work that in, and that may help a bit. But the main requirement, full sun and a well-drained soil.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Good luck, Larry. And we have just a little time left. Let's try to get through some questions quickly. Alicia in Cedar Rapids has some lilac bushes that are overgrown. Is it okay to trim them right now?
I do that, again, late dormant season, February, March.
All right. Another trimming question from Isabel. I have a beautiful maple tree that has grown a lot in the past summers and consequently has reduced the amount of sun I get in my garden. Could I still prune it? And if not, when will be the best time to do that? And what do you do with trees that grow as much and therefore overshadow other plants?
You find a different garden site is one.
Good. That's a great answer. Because I'm not a big fan of thinning trees to favor a garden. I love veg gardens, but thinning a tree isn't always the best thing for the tree. So perhaps relocating the garden is a better idea.
All right. But if she wants to prune it, can she do it now?
Again, late dormant season.
All right. And here's a question from Jeff. I'm in Ames. I perhaps planted hardneck garlic bulbs a bit too early this season. First thing in October, I'm seeing some of them growing leaves above ground already. I was expecting them to pop up in the spring. Are they going to die back in the winter and then grow again in the spring?
I think they'll come back. I would cover that. This is supposed to be, next week is supposed to be a very cold week. And I think I would cover them later next week with several inches of straw.
All right, so prepare for the cold.
Yes, and then they should come back next spring.
All right, and we are out of time. Thank you to everybody with questions this week. Jeff Iles, thank you so much.
It was fun, thanks.
Jeff Iles, professor and chair of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University, and Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. We will be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.